The title of my talk is about supervised learning in neural network models, and in particular a new type of neural network which I will talk about is called a small world network. There's a different kind which is related to this, what's called a scale-free network. What I want to do in my talk, I will give you some idea of this new architecture of networks which has its origin some time ago. It came from some ideas in psychology in the 60s, and it has been, so to say, discovered only in 1908, so there's about 4 or 5 years of work on these architectures. And actually it was found that these architectures already existed. People have used them without knowing, and so to say, it has only become realized that this is quite widely used. And to establish a relation to what the subject of this conference is, I want to tell you, as I was introduced just a minute ago, my aim is not really data mining. I'm coming from physics and I'm interested in neuroscience, in particular modeling and understanding of the brain. But on the other hand, I know that, for instance, supervised learning has used networks, and these networks are modeled in a certain way by the structure of the brain. So again, small world architecture has been discovered from the physiological side to be realized in the brain. And the question is now, are eventually those architectures also beneficial for improving network working and facilities? So what I will basically do in this talk, I will present, first of all, what I mean by a small world network, or the idea of small world architecture. Then I will give some examples. And the second part, then I will go more in particular in examples where a small world architecture is realized in biological systems and related in even in human brain. And in the last part, then I will talk about learning algorithms or learning in supervised modes of multi-layer feed-forward neural networks. Okay, so three parts, as I said. I will spend most of the time on the first two parts, and the last part will be maybe 30% or so. These papers are relatively recent, so if you want to take a look, the first one here is, I think, is a very good article, which is quite easily readable, and it gives you some idea what this thing is about. I will tell you historically, the first incentive to study these networks was an experiment by Milgram, which was done in the 60s, and this experiment has become quite famous among people in sociology, and it talks about to transport a letter, not by usually mail, but by person-to-person contact. And the experiment was carried out like follows. People were asked to send letters from some place in Nebraska to Boston, and they were asked to send the letter not by mail, but to give it to a person whom they know and who possibly had other connections to people maybe living closer to Boston. And the experiment turned out to be partially successful, that, let's say, a number of letters came in, maybe 20% or so, and they were delivered from person to person and arrived in Boston. And the surprising fact was that there were not maybe hundreds of thousands of intermediate people who were necessary to transmit these letters, but approximately six or seven persons only. So that is why these small world networks are also today sometimes called the network of 6 degrees of separation. So here's a comparison of a statistics done by modeling such a network, and these are the real experiments which has been repeated later, and it seems to be explaining that the maximum of this curve lies by six intermediate steps. So that's why we talk today of a kind of representation of the organization of the human society, and experiments like that have been done also in different ways. For instance, by a pizza baker in Berlin, by how many connections he is related to, let's say, a movie actor in Los Angeles, and the numbers is usually also always in the order of six. So everybody in our society now has via five to eight intermediate persons or connections to anybody else in the world. So that is a principal property of our organization. But this kind of organization is not only present in human society, but also in other disciplines and in other areas, and I will tell you that in a moment. But just let me give you one property, what a small world network means. It means that society has high local clustering. Clustering is characterized by a clustering coefficient C, and it means, it tells you how many connections I have in my direct neighborhood. So, for instance, I myself, if I know, let's say, four friends, and if these friends also know each other, then they have possible six over six possible connections that is clustering one. However, if they know only a few of them know each other, then the clustering is smaller. So small world network has one property that means locally around me, people know each other. When I know them, they know very likely also each other. This is a high clustering coefficient, which is one characteristic property of a small world network. Another one is a small average length. So the average length is just the number of links which are needed in between. So when the letter goes to Boston, it means the links length is about six. And the other property is, in a statistical sense, how many average connections are needed, and this number L should be small. So in this respect, alpha is a parameter which modifies the architecture of the network. The range where the small world network exists is in this area where L is relatively low and C is relatively high. So one sees for random networks, for instance, the clustering is, for instance, quite low, which is not typical for a small world network. So this shows you how one can construct a small world network. Again, in a very simple mathematical model, one can start from a kind of periodic circular network, where every node is connected to a second neighbor node. And the other extreme is a random network, where all nodes are connected, but quite randomly. And the small world network, to give you an idea, means a network which has almost the regular structure, so there's high local clustering, but there are a few long connections, like here. So if I want to go from here to there, I do not hop to my next neighbor and so on, but I can go directly here. So, but there are only a few of them, and these few make the difference. So again, this represented here statistically by saying that C over normalized to normal clustering is relatively high, and the path length is relatively small. So if one constructs these in computer models, one can do this by progressively starting from a regular network and then going to a random network. Now this is another example of a network, just to tell you that other possibilities of course exist. This kind of architecture was involuntarily already discussed very early in the 60s in the context of asking the questions how the internet should be structured, and Paul Baran suggested or discussed different types. And one is the one which is highly centralized, so there's one big hub connecting all the persons, and on the other hand there's a kind of more or less average dense net web, and also decentralized with a few hubs. And the critic was that this should not be good for the reason it's very vulnerable to attack. For instance, if a terrorist would, let's say, kill this node here, then the whole network would break down. On the other hand, this structure here is more or less what is today called a scale-free network. At that time it was not recognized, but really the internet today looks more or less like that. So, just to recall what are the properties of this network. Why is, for instance, the clustering, which is locally high, why is this a good idea? Well, it means that the network is, in a sense, redundant, like in the brain. We know when in the brain neurons are dying all the time, and if one of the neurons is dying, still our brain remains functional. So it's very stable for errors. And why is this short path length beneficial? Well, it helps for rapid communication. So for instance, in the society experiment of Milgram, it explains the why only a few intermediate persons are necessary. And it also helps, the World Wide Web is organized also like a small world network, and it explains why a search really works fast. In the brain, there are different numbers of examples, and I will come to that a little bit later. It explains fast system response and coherent activation in the motor cortex. Fast system response we need, for instance, if an animal is under attack and has to flee from a predator. Then the motor cortex sets on in motion, and there's contraction of very many muscles at the same time. So it's crucial that the brain is capable of high coherent and very fast response. So one could think now, okay, why is a network which is only has a few short nodes, is that maybe the ideal network? So one could think, well, maybe I would like to have high local clustering and I have a very short path length, but is that the best network? And the question is, in principle, this is not possible. For instance, in the brain, we know the brain has very diluted connections. So one has about 10 to the 4 connections for every neuron, and we have about 10 to the 11 neurons, and that means every neuron is not at all connected to all the rest. So if that would be, the brain should be should not have enough space. So the brain could only contain maybe 100 neurons if every brain neuron would be connected with the other one. Though that's simply not possible. So, but still we know that the brain is working very well. So let me come to a few examples of small world networks. So one I mentioned already, which is this letter experiment carried out or proposed by Milgram. There are other examples, like for instance, we know it's not so surprising when a human society is structured in this way that also, let's say, board members of big corporations are organized like this, so they know each other, and it's quite usual that if you are a member of a board, then you will be elected to become member of a board of another society. So that explains this fact and explains also phenomena that, let's say, richer people get more rich and so. So it's, I think, very many nice properties. So also film actors are organized like that. Mathematicians are organized like that. There's a, for instance, a network of publications of Paul Erdős, who was a Hungarian mathematician, and he was very prolific in producing papers. And so people can say, okay, look, if I was co-author of Paul Erdős, I get number one. If I was co-author of some person who was co-author with Paul Erdős, he gets number two, and so you can define a distance, and that gives also a kind of small world network. In electrical engineering, for instance, the power lines of power distribution, high electric voltage power lines in the Western US are organized like small world network. In communication, it's the World Wide Web, the Internet. Biology, there are numerous examples. Just to mention a few, it's the metabolic network of a bacterium, E. coli. It's the neural system of a small animal, the nematode worm C. elegans, which was came into focus for studies of genetics. The genetic code of this animal has been deciphered, but also its neural code. And this is an animal which has all the same number of neurons. That's why one can really make precise statements. And they have a small world network architecture. Just to give you some statistics, so as I said, the neural network of this nematode worm C. elegans has been analyzed. It has about 282 neurons. The clustering coefficient is 0.28. And in comparison to a random network, it's an order of magnitude larger. So it's large. It has high local clustering. The path length is 2.6 compared to a random network of 2.1. So it's small, but not really smaller than random, it's, let's say, comparable. The visual cortex of a monkey, the macaque monkey, is also given here. And again, it has high local clustering and comparable short path lengths. And also the cat cortex has been analyzed, and it's relatively similar. So these are examples showing that the brain structure of mammals seems to have this structure. However, one has to say that the real number of neurons which have been analyzed is tremendously small, though, so from the statistical sense, it's not really reliable. But on the other hand, it's very difficult to make precise measurements because the number of neurons is in the 10 to the 10 or what I said, and that's why it's very complicated. So we will probably not have in the next 10 years a precise brain map of the human brain which tells us how the neurons are really connected. But I will show you a little bit later a map of the brain not coming by counting the neurons but by counting the activity correlations. Yeah, here's another statistic. So also the movie access network. Yeah, this is another example. It's basically the same thing as the Paul Address network. The movie actor Kevin Bacon has played in many movies, and so you can also construct a network from that. So here you see statistics. So on average, let's say there that the Bacon number is 3 of his movie actor colleagues. So another example in biology, the food web of fish in ocean. So one fish eats other fish, and this connection gives a web, and the web has organization of a small world network. Another example is a protein network in yeast. It looks like also a little bit like this internet network. I will show you a little bit later. Now, here comes another thing which is very important today, namely the scale-free network. What is a scale-free network? To give you a pictorial idea, it's like a little bit like the map of the airline connections in the United States. So, for instance, Chicago or Atlanta also, there are very many connections to other airports in the world or in the United States, but there are small airports somewhere in the country which have few connections. So, in other words, there are hubs which have many connections and very many other small airports which have lesser connections. And if one plots the number of connections per site, one finds a power law behavior. So if one plots it on a logarithmic scale, it gives a straight line. And this is a new type of network which is, so to say, a subspecies of the small world network, but it's very widely realized, and I will show you. So, for instance, the internet is of the scale-free structure. It has very big hubs and very many nodes which are not so highly connected. And here is this logarithmic plot of the number of nodes and shows a nice straight line on the logarithmic scale. Yeah, again, what is a typical property of scale-free networks? Again, it helps for the rapid propagation of computer viruses. It is also stable against local errors, but it's again very vulnerable if, for instance, these hubs, these nodes with very many connections fail or are, so to say, destroyed. So, for instance, if one would attack the internet by, let's say, destroying some central nodes, then the whole internet would break down. And maybe also the power line failures in the United States have something to do with this structure. Another example, which is also the propagation of infectious diseases. So here is shown the number of shortcuts. And this is the threshold for infection. So if a disease is infectious, it needs, so to say, a certain threshold of infectiousness. And if one changes the structure of the connection from, let's say, regular to a small world network, then this and the fraction of shortcuts is increasing. Then if this increases and becomes more and more small world, then the infectiousness threshold can go down and still make the system infectious. In other words, the spreading of the disease when introducing shortcuts will be more easy. And that's what we see today in the infectious diseases like influenza or whatever disease which came from China, which we all have seen here in Toronto. This is due to these shortcuts via airplanes or other very rapid ways to communicate. Okay, the high vulnerability is demonstrated here again. So if one has a network which has just a central hub, then it's highly or extremely highly vulnerable. Now, part two, let me discuss a few examples in neuroscience in particular. And I mentioned already the structure of the cortex in cat and the visual system of this macaque monkey. I will talk now another example, namely the structure of the human brain, but not measured by really looking at the structure of the neurons, but by an activity measurement coming from magnetic resonance imaging. And well, here I have a slide before which says something about nonlinear dynamics and complexity. And well, everybody knows that if one studies mechanics, one has usually very simple systems, maybe linear system. And on the other hand, systems which are highly nonlinear and very complex, for example, like the human brain, they can show properties which we call today self-organization, self-organized criticality. So that means the brain is able to maintain certain levels of activity by itself. And a very simple example of this is, maybe you have heard of it, the sand pile model. So if you look at the pile of sand and you create avalanches and the sand is dry, it will restructure itself to give the same slope. And this is a simple model of self-organized criticality which occurs in the brain. So brain research, but this is, so to say, not the main line. The brain research today is very interested in this self-organized criticality because it's part of the brain. Now, this is what I was mentioning before, the structure of the human brain, but measured by a functional map. And these were data which were taken by the Northwestern University Chicago group by magnetic imaging signals, and then establishing correlation matrices between points when the activity was beyond a certain threshold. So establishing these links then produces a network. And this network was characterized to be a small world network, in particular of the scale-free architecture. In other words, the number of links and the number of connections shows this typical logarithmic straight line behavior. Not here in the beginning, but let's say over a certain three orders of magnitude. The different curves correspond to different ways of connecting the connections, measuring the connections with a certain critical parameter. And if the network would not be scale-free, it would have, let's say, Gaussian distribution as a reference, and this is quite different what one sees here. These power laws also occur in the brain or have been measured experimentally. If one looks at neural avalanches, for instance, in epileptic attacks, and the size of the area where these neural avalanches occur have also a distribution law which is of a power law form, so it's also scale-free. Now, here again is the statistics from the magnetic imaging of the brain. The number of neurons is now very much higher than it was in the previous data for the small nematode worm or the macaque or cat cortex. So we have now 30,000, for instance. Local connectivity 0.14 is much higher than the corresponding random value. And the typical path length is 11 compared to randomly 4, which is a little bit larger, but let's say comparable to the order of magnitude. So I think one can nevertheless talk of a small world network, in particular of the subclass of the scale-free architecture. Now I want to talk a little bit about computational models. People, what are people doing when they try to understand the brain and then make a computer model and study these models? And I want to just briefly mention two models which people have made with the purpose to understand the functioning of the brain. And the first one is about this property of fast system response and coherence. And the second one is about memory. Here, in the first model, one has used a network of Hodgkin-Huxley neurons. What means that? Hodgkin-Huxley was a group of two British researchers which in the 50s made models which explained the membrane potential of neurons and wrote differential equations which are still used today. They are phenomenologically but very good. And these membrane potentials depend on voltage and resistance and can be described as electrical circuits. Now here people have made a network of neurons of these model type of, let's say, electrical circuits, which however are interconnected by a small world architecture. And in particular, this small world connection is on a circle, as I showed you before. And what one observes is then that this has a small world geometry, namely high local clustering, short path lengths, and it represents fast response and coherent oscillation. So here in the lowest graph, it shows the degree of coherence, which is relatively high. So this is an interesting model because, as I said, this represents features which the brain has. And in particular, I think it's interesting to explain the phenomenon of binding in the brain. Let's briefly tell you what it means. Binding means if you notice, let's say, a car which moves on the road and passes behind a wall, and you see part of the bus on the left and the other part coming out at the right. And if you wouldn't know that it would be a bus, you would still, your brain would imagine an image of the complete part of the bus without seeing the whole, only the two ends. And this is called the binding mechanism, and it was not really understood how this works. But one knows that there has to be high coherence, and in the sense this is maybe a rudimentary model to explain also this binding phenomenon in the brain. The efficient associative memory model is about the following thing. One wants to explain memory. And associative memory can be explained in terms of different physical models. Sometimes people use models of spin glasses in physics. Spin glasses are systems which are used in atomic physics to describe the spin and the magnetic interaction. But similar models can be mapped to also describe the state of activity of or non-activity of neurons. And for instance, there's a Hopfield model or Sheridan-Kirkpatrick model. Now, what I want to say here, this is about the question of using different networks and storing information and trying to recover the information which is partially corrupted. And here again, one starts from a regular spherical network. A random would have connections like this, and small word would have a few direct connections. And as a result, one observes that the problem of recovering corrupted information, maybe I show you another graph, is very well done if the network is of small world structure. For instance, here is a regular network. This is, so to say, showing this is a probability of correction. So if it's corrected, then it's 1. But here the regular network, so to say, after initial condition, it's corrupted. Here it's very bad. After one iteration, it's improving a little bit. But after 20 iterations, it's still only 20% restored. So it's very far away from the complete restoration. But if one looks at a random network, after already 5 iterations, it's extremely well reproduced. And finally, a small world network does the same job after, let's say, 40 iterations. So the small world network is very, very good compared to regular network, but it's not so good as a random network, but still relatively successful here. Okay. Maybe I should. I want to say a few words about this. Without going in detail, there's much more work coming out recently on another models describing properties of the brain and in connection of the small world architecture. So it has been suggested by neuroscientists that the working of the memory has to do with self-sustained activity. And self-sustained activity of excitable neurons has been modeled again in a network model using small world architecture. So here small world architecture is crucial to produce this self-sustained activity, and this is by neurobiologists also known as one characteristic important property. Other people have studied pattern recognition. Again, they have used a model of a Hopfield network, which is usually connected to learning. And they used a scale-free architecture. And again, it was found that this is very efficient. Last example, which is very recent, it came out just very briefly. It's about trying to understand the disease of epilepsy in the brain. And the model which they have done is again using a system of neurons with small world architecture. And this small world architecture is responsible to create long and short bursts from different areas in the brain of the hippocampus where these epilepsy attacks are originating from. So again, these bursts, different types of bursts, short and long bursts, are characteristic for epilepsy. And with a small world architecture, one can model these kind of effects. So what I want to say with these examples is that there's apparently a number of works which are demonstrating that some features of the brain can be maybe in a rudimentary way, but nevertheless represented by networks which have this new small world, or in particular scale-free architecture. Now I want to come now, let's say, to the main part of the talk, which is an application again of the small world architecture, and now for the purpose of learning. Now, as we have heard from the director of Generation 5, that learning is very important, and in particular unsupervised learning is very important, because the brain is effectively doing mostly unsupervised learning. On the other hand, historically, in artificial intelligence, supervised learning has been used very much. And what the brain does is not really fully understood. On the other hand, we know something about the organization of these networks in the brain. For instance, in the visual cortex, we know that there are six layers. And the information is organized in the layer such that each neuron in the layer is basically connected to the next layer. So it's a feed-forward network with very small lateral connections, but mostly it's a feed-forward network. And on the other hand, the unsupervised learning in feed-forward networks has been used very much, because people have found good algorithms like the backpropagation algorithm, which is an algebraic procedure to adapt the weights of the network. And in particular, one has found that one can do this without using, let's say, not five or six layers as the visual cortex in the brain has, but only maybe two. In particular, one reason was that if people were trying to apply this backpropagation algorithm to more layers, then it became more and more complicated. Eventually, it did not work very well. What I will show you now here is an example of studying the learning problem, and again using the backpropagation rule in supervised learning. And the difference is now that I organize my connections in a forward feeding network, but a network which has in addition a small world architecture. In other words, I want to see if I organize my forward connected network in a small world architecture, does that make a difference? And as I said, from my background, being a physicist and interested in problems in neuroscience, my basic drive to this problem comes from the neuroscience aspect, in order to understand the working of the brain. But apparently, because as I said, the whole idea of neural networks comes from the idea, or comes taken over from neurobiology. So it may be that also taking over the small world architecture, which apparently has been shown to exist in the brain, may be also interesting for improving artificial networks. So I want to show you now some results, and you will see to which degree this is successful. So I start again to tell you how this is organized. So one has, let's say, an input layer, and then there's a second layer, a third layer, fourth and a fifth layer, and an output. And as I said, like in the brain, in the visual cortex, we have in our model no lateral connections, but only feed-forward connections. So in a regular network, each neuron of each layer is connected to all other neurons in the next layer. All right, that's what I call a regular network. And in the random network, again, feed forward like this, this neuron here could be connected not only to the next layer, but could have connections to the second or the third or even the last layer. So a completely random network would have only feed forward connections, but not only to the next layer, but mostly to all the layers in the same likelihood. However, the small world is somewhere in between. It has what we say a few shortcuts, so it's basically like the regular network, but a few of these connections are cut and randomly replaced by longer connections like the red ones here, which go maybe hop to the second next or third next layer. All right, and if I change the network from here to there, what I would do, I would mathematically characterize it by a number of rewiring. So the red one means one connection is cut and rewired. Okay, I also want to mention that random means also there is no backward connection, it's only feed forward. And yeah. So let me give you some very simple examples using a 5x5 network. It means it has five neurons per layer and five layers. And in order to characterize the geometry of the network, I use two coefficients which are not local clustering and short path lengths, but two new functions called d-local and d-global. These are not exactly the same, they are slightly different, but they have the same interpretation. So it has been shown that effectively they play the same role. So when the network is small world, that means local clustering is high and path length is short, then these two functions should both be small. So in this curve here, the global, this one is the full line and the others are the points. So these two functions are small in this region here. So you see here the number of rewiring, about, let's say, 20 or so, corresponds to the structure which is most small world. So we can say here about 20-30 rewirings generate from starting a regular network, a small world network, and if one continues the rewiring, that one ends up in a random network, and then these two functions are not small at all. One can imagine that if one changes the network, for instance, here is a 10 by 10 network, 10 neurons in 10 layers, then the number of rewiring is different. But again, one sees that there is an area where these two coefficients are small, and then this would be the region where the network would be a small world. Yeah, now I want to show you some results. In particular, I want to show also the learning time. So in my definition, learning time I use as a definition to measure how often one has to present a pattern for learning until the end result has an error which is smaller than a given error limit. So I pose a given error limit and then I ask how many times I have to present the pattern such that the result of supervised learning is satisfied. And here I show the learning time again for the 5x5 network. and extremely low number of learning patterns, one, which is of course stupid, but just to show what it happens. And here, this is also not a very visible picture, but here the data points are going down. So one sees the learning time as a function of rewiring is not constant, but it goes down. And so, well, this changes if I use, for instance, two patterns, which is all extremely small, but still the statistics here is also not very good, but one can see there's some point where the learning time is small, is a minimum. And if I use three patterns, then the curve looks like this. So here I have now a clearer minimum of the learning time, and the number of rewirings is in the order of 40, 50. And maybe you remember that I told you that the 5x5 network is most small world. The two coefficients, d global and d local, have a minima at about 30 rewirings. So there seems to be a coincidence of the small world, that the network becomes small world architecture at the same time when the learning time is small. And here, the same thing I show you for the 10x10 network, again with a small, very small number of patterns. Learning time has a minimum at about, let's say, 450. And here I show also these two geometric functions, d global and d local, and they have a minimum about 400 to 450. So it seems there's actually, in this case at least, a coincidence of a minimization of learning time just when the architecture is most small world. But this is certainly depending on the architecture and the number of the neurons and the number of patterns. So here I want to show you now not the learning time, but the error. So I do now not look at the learning time itself, but I look just at the error in reproducing the learned patterns. And I plot this error as a function of the number of layers. So I use a different number of layers, and I also change the connectivity. So for instance, here we have 8 layers and regular architecture. So the error stays relatively high if I do rewiring. So 8 layers with rewiring, now you see the error is much smaller. So it went, instead of remaining here for the regular network, rewiring of 8 layers, now the error is about almost a factor 3 better. Or if I start with a 7 layers network, the regular architecture, the error drops, so to say, very slowly. And if I have rewiring of 7 layers, then again the error is quite sizable, smaller. Same thing for 6 layers, and again with rewiring here, and 5 layers here, and rewired 5 layers here. So in all cases, one sees that rewiring, that means introducing a few shortcuts, improves the error in the learning curve. And particularly, as you can see here, for regular networks, if there are too many layers, it does not learn at all. So the number of patterns in this case, is 20, which is also not very small. But on the other hand, the network is also a small network. Now let's take a look at a different case. These are now only 5 layers, 5 neurons, 5 layers, and I look at learning of 5 patterns. Again, the absolute error, this is 0, means regular. There's no rewiring, the error goes down with the number of iterations. And then 10 rewirings, a small number of rewirings, the error is smaller, but at the end the red points are hidden here, but at the end they more or less coincide with the black curve. So in other words, if one does only a few iterations to improve the error, already 10 rewirings make a difference, but at the end, if one once goes to the asymptotic regime, it does not make a difference. The same thing with a higher number of rewirings, 20, 30, or 40. So the, let's say the blue curve corresponds to 40 rewirings. Again, in the beginning it's better than the regular network, but at the end, in this case, it comes out more or less like the same thing. Well, here one goes a little bit further to 500,000 iterations, and then one can see that the rewiring of 20 seems still better than the black dots, which remains the regular network slightly. So there's not much difference. But what I want to say is this is a kind of artificial example again, because there are only 5 patterns to be learned, and that is very far from, let's say, a network which wants to learn a large number of patterns in the order of its capacity. So now what we want to do now to increase the number of patterns, now we go from 5 to 20 patterns and see how it looks like now. Again, it's not the maximum capacity, but it's more than before. Again, the black dots are those for regular network. So they'll go like this. Then the red ones are 10 rewirings and the green 20. And again, there's not much of a difference here. But if one looks at the data for 500,000 rewirings, one can see in the small details that the regular network is a little bit worse in the error than, let's say, the light blue one with 40 rewirings or 20 rewirings. So a small world network with a few rewirings gives some improvement. Now we have 80 patterns, so we are coming now in the order of the capacity of the network. And in this case, it's very clear that zero rewiring, namely the regular network, is performing best. And the reason seems to be that the network is working in the area where the capacity is either achieved or overachieved. In other words, the load is higher than the real capacity of the network. Then the advantage of a small world architecture does not play a role. And in this case, it seems that the regular network is doing best. Another example, 5 layers and 8 neurons, 40 patterns. This gives also a kind of extreme case. Again, rewiring zero is this flat curve. In other words, it fails to learn. One can go up to 500,000 iterations, and it does not learn at all. On the other hand, if one introduces only a very minor number of rewirings, like the red curve, 10 or 20, then it learns very well. So this is a very clear example showing that rewiring in the direction of a small world network really improves the situation. Okay. So we have now slightly more neurons than layers. We have only 5 layers, but we have more neurons than before. Now we have a larger number of layers. We have gone up even to 15. And again, then we see regular, and the deep blue one is 30. So 30 rewirings seem to do better. And random, and the random architecture is 1 with 100 in this area with the open squares, which is not so good at all. So also in this case, the random and the regular network are both worse than the small world architecture. Again, a look at connectivity for this network of 8 layers and 50 neurons. One can see that this functions deglobal and delocal both. So the minima do not coincide, but there's an area where they both are small, and that would correspond to about rewiring of about 30. Yeah, here one shows, so to say, the optimal number of shortcuts. This is the number of iterations here, these numbers, and one can see as a function of patterns. So for instance, if one has 40 patterns, the minimum of the learning time lies by about 160,000 iterations, somewhere here, and the rewiring number corresponding is 20. So this seems to be small world. Okay, now I want to more or less come to the end. I want to show just two examples of generalization. Here we have used five neuron, five layer network, and we have as given as a problem to classify it into five classes, and it was a relatively simple test as a classification was just, let's say, values of real numbers in a certain range. And these are the errors for after learning of the trained patterns, and these are the untrained patterns, so the patterns which are classified. And one can see again the trained patterns. In this case, the best one is the 20 rewirings. The black curve is almost as good, but not as good. But for the new, for the classified pattern, the best one is the light blue squares, which is in this case zero, or the very few, the rhombus, which is 20. So generalization error is best in the order from 0 to 20 rewirings. Another example is a 5 by 8 network, and then one can see these are again the training patterns. Again, small world is a lot better here compared to the regular one, but also the classified pattern zero rewiring is now here, those are the green ones, for instance, is 80 or 40 rewiring, so they are quite remarkably different than the classification without small world architecture. So again, learning now here, classification with small world architecture in this case does a lot better. So I come to the summary. At the summary, one observes that for small number of patterns, there is a small advantage in a short learning time, but actually it's not very interesting. On the other hand, if one considers too many patterns, then the network depasses its maximum capacity, then the regular architecture is best, and the average error is also high. But if one has a number of patterns which are, let's say, between the two extremes, then actually the small world network seems to be doing quite well. If one asks for implications in neurobiology, I think this model may eventually be helpful for understanding learning in the brain, because we know this backpropagation rule, which we use as an algorithm, is not realized in the real brain, that is no. Also, it may give insight in more complexity, structure of the organization of the brain and its functional tasks. One may ask the question, maybe is a fast learning process and maybe a correlation to a small world architecture even a kind of constraint for the evolution of species and the evolution of the neural system, of the nervous system of species? It's possible, it's just a fictitious question. And one can use this model also to make some predictions of the geometry of the visual cortex, and one obtains the numbers which are not too far far different from the experimentally measured values for this nematode von C. elegans. And the future work, of course, this data which I have presented to you are, so to say, model data for very small network. They are very far away from a real application in industry like you people are mostly interested in. So one question is, can we generalize these results for real big network and see if they are still valid? In particular, as I said in the beginning, in real networks in industry, people use only a small number of layers for the reason because also this backpropagation rule seems not to work. But here, as I've shown, we have used even a high number of layers up to 15, and it seems to work there. The backpropagation rule seems to work when I introduce the small world architecture. There's another thing which we have not really understood why this is functioning. And then the second thing is, we are also interested in going to unsupervised learning, eventually Hebbian learning, and again study how this behaves on small world and scale-free architecture. And eventually also the question of memory on these architectures is to be explored. And because for official application, I think this, maybe you have seen, this is came out 4 years ago, but now I think it's actual again. You only have to replace the name. Thank you very much.